Yeah, she's in the guise of a woman, but
yeah,
she's one of the guys.
Just yeah.
I mean, I remember seeing her talk against militia groups back when after the federal government building, I mean the Oklahoma building got blown up, and I thought, wow, she's right there with the right wing. Just the way she talked, anyway.
Well, I haven't paid too much attention.
I suppose it's not easy.
I've seen the land deal she pulled for her husband. Her husband's very involved in. He's quite a wheeler and dealer, and she's done tremendous conflict of interest deals to her husband through some very lucrative deals down in the desert down in Southern California, also some trade negotiations with China.
Okay, Tom, so who do we have for governor if we get rid of Davis? We have Huffington, Schwarzenegger. Oh,
well,
we got Arnold.
It would be very difficult
Arnold's
to do
ready.
A person than we have now. That's all.
Oh, you got Schwarzenegger in there, or... whatever his name is, and...
Well, again, there's a person, you know, maybe he has one or two good ideas, I don't know. I haven't listened to his ideas yet.
What if Davis...
But does he have any real experience running
good
any
idea.
Kind of organization? And you really look for that. You want to get some kind of track record. You don't want to elect somebody because they are saying some nice things. You want somebody that you believe actually has experience to do a good job and has shown that they can do a good job. And... those kind of people are actually few and far in between now.
Okay. Well, I bet somebody else wants to call you. I don't know.
Well, we're getting towards the end of our program. So, well, thank you for calling in. That's put people on notice then.
Tomorrow night. I'm going to try and be there.
You'll be down there.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Go to the Resource Center for Nonviolence if anyone's out there. And I'm sure that if they get on there, they can get Sharon to send them something about it. I think I know there are other groups as well.
Okay. Well, that sounds
thank you,
great.
Tom. Okay, bye.
Bye now. Well, let's see. We just have a few minutes left. I was kind of going through the local state budget follies, the county follies, and the city follies. I have two articles left here I was hoping to get through. I think I'll touch upon... I was talking about the article on fascism by the Connections magazine. I would direct everyone's attention out there to pick it up. If you're just tuning in now... locally, there's a lot of Connections magazines, and they're all over town, and they have this great centerpiece on called The Meridian, and there's a great reprint of Senator Byrd's article questioning George Bush's judgment in rushing us into war in Iraq, and what he knew, when he knew it, and so forth. Several excellent articles, but there's one that has an article entitled The 12 Different Aspects of Fascism. It's a great article, and a lot of people on the so-called left and the so-called right are describing this more and more as a real problem in our country right now. So when you have so many people with very different political viewpoints saying the same thing, I think it's time to pay attention to that. And I'm looking at an article here. I direct your attention to commondreams.org. A kind of fascism is replacing our democracy. Many questions on that, but I'll see you next week at 7 o'clock Monday.
Stan here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. I'm bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line one of my favorite authors, Ellen Gunderson Traylor. We're talking about her books, The Priest and the Oracle. And of course, these are fascinating, fascinating books. They're a little different than what she usually writes. Ordinarily, she writes biblical fiction, and by biblical, I mean it's not fiction. It's all based upon the events as they occurred, and whether it be Mary Magdalene and Noah, or John, or a book on Jerusalem, or Melchizedek, or so many of the people who are key figures in biblical history. They're wonderful, wonderful novels that make the whole story of the Bible come alive, and not one variation at all from the way it was written in the scriptures. But of course, her latest two books, The Priest and the Oracle, are simply telling about what's going on as far as Israel is concerned, their preparation for the latter days, their preparation for rebuilding the temple, for reinstituting the sacrifices, the blood sacrifices, which have not been there at temple for 1900 years because they haven't had a temple. And of course, against the backdrop of what's happening in the world today, their books are based upon fiction. But Helen does a tremendous amount of research on all of these books, and I think you'll find them fascinating. We actually carry them here at Radio Liberty, because they give you tremendous insight into what's going on. And, of course, the hero is one of the Indiana Jones-type characters. He sort of makes Indiana Jones look sort of like a piker or somebody. Well, anyway, let's get to Ellen. Hi, Ellen. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Anyway, of course, what motivated you to write The Priest and then The Oracle? And hopefully the third in the trilogy will be coming before too long.
Well, thank you again for having me on. And you know, in about 1993 or 4, I was asked by one of my publishers to do a book on Jerusalem for the 3,000th anniversary of Jerusalem, which the Jews would be celebrating in 1996. And their 3,000th anniversary was the anniversary of David's taking of the city as his capital. So I began to research, and when I first started to ponder doing a book for that celebration, of course I went to Jerusalem a couple of times. My publisher and my editor sent me there and also met me there and had a number of interviews and tours for me set up already so that I could meet key figures in Jerusalem today. And at that time, I was considering doing a historical analysis of Jerusalem, going back to the beginnings of the city and going on up, which of course ended up to be my book, Jerusalem, the City of God. That was the book that ended up being the one that they had hired me to write. However, in my research for that book, because I was speaking with several modern-day Israelis, Orthodox Jews involved in the Temple movement in Jerusalem, and also archaeologists and various characters on the Jerusalem scene today who were very much involved in the in the temple movement or very much aware of the temple movement, that really sparked my interest in that topic as well. So while I went over there to primarily to study the history of Jerusalem for an archaeological novel on Jerusalem, at the same time, this burning interest developed based on my talks with rabbis and archaeologists there in the current temple movement in Israel. So from that came a lot of what you see in the priest and the oracle.
Well, I think the most interesting thing to me is that only at this time in history would they be able to actually identify the direct descendant of Aaron, who would be, of course, the high priest of Israel. Now, you can do this, of course, by genetic typing, and they can actually follow the line of Aaron down to modern-day times, and they are actually utilizing this sort of technology, aren't they, searching for the priest?
Well, I'll tell you, it was most exciting because when I began investigating this whole area of interest in the temple, one question kept really bothering me, and that was, okay, say they put their temple together, say they begin to initiate worship there and so forth, won't they need to reinstitute the high priesthood? And that question bothered me the whole time I was over there doing this research, and I asked the question of so many people who should have known or should have had some insight into the question of how will they identify their high priest. And, you know, I got the strangest responses from the people I spoke to. They either shrugged their shoulders and said, well, I never thought of that before, which would be possible, I suppose, if you're just speaking to an archaeologist or something. But when you're speaking to the people in the temple movement, the response was different. It was one of, what leads you to ask this question? And who are you? And in fact, one of them who is pretty well known, a lot of people may have heard of him, Haim Richman, who is kind of the curator at the Temple Institute, which in my books is the Temple Consortium, he said to me, who are you? Why are you asking these questions? And what do you know?
Aha. Uh-huh. So they were worried that you might, of course, be getting too close to what this is really all about. And ladies and gentlemen, there really are people there. They believe that it's only a matter of time before the temple will be rebuilt. Now, you may, of course, wonder, well, how are you going to build a temple there? You know, and especially if it has anything to do with this great stone on the top of Mount Moriah, where Abraham, of course, sacrificed or was going to sacrifice Isaac. And, of course, I believe that's where the temple was initially. There may be questions to that. But that's right in the very center of the Mosque of Omar, that beautiful building with a gold dome top. And, of course, if the Israelis were to tear that down, there would be a holy war that just would never stop. And yet, of course, the Jews believe that God is going to destroy that temple, and at that point, they can build their own temple. So, they are totally dedicated to this, but they're looking to God for guidance. They've got a lot of faith that the Lord's going to do it, don't they?
Oh, they do, absolutely. And if we have a little time, I might give you some hints about my third book in the series, which deals with that whole issue of how the Dome of the Rock would ultimately be resolved as a stumbling block to this process. And you asked earlier about the genetic testing for the high priest, and I was going to go on and let you know that in the midst of all this investigation that I was doing, an article came out in the Jerusalem Post talking about a new surprise that had just come on into genetics, and that was that in analyzing the saliva of males in the line of the priesthood, they discovered that there is a genetic marker in Cohen males, that's C-O-H-E-N, Cohen males, which harks clear back to Aaron and is present in every legitimate Cohen male in the world. And they trace this to Cohens in every culture and every race across the world. There are Cohens who exist in China, Ireland, Ethiopia, Russia. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, doesn't matter what you look like. If you have this marker, you are a Cohen. And that was only discovered, Stan, in the very beginning times when I started to study this whole thing. Lo and behold, they made this discovery. So that discovery was made in time for me to be able to include that whole notion in my book, The Priest.
And, of course, the book starts out, of course, with this archaeologist, I guess he is, or is he an archaeologist? He certainly is studies ancient languages.
I have him being an archaeologist and a linguist.
Okay. And, of course, so he is picked by the group of rabbis to help them track down the priest. And, of course, they have to have somebody who can read the ancient manuscripts, and, of course, this fellow is an atheist. He doesn't believe in the Jewish race at all, but of course he's intrigued by this offer. They want him, and he's been picked from all the people in the world to do this, but he doesn't realize, of course, that there are other people who, of course, don't want this to happen. And of course, what Ellen did, she had the opportunity during the McVeigh trial to spend several hours with Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney. Now, you must understand that what happened in Oklahoma City, you've never heard the truth on that. I mean, there was a Near Eastern connection on that, and apparently there were some right-wing Nazi type of people tied into Elohim City. And so you find these people, almost Nazi types, joining force with Arab types to participate in this blowing up of the building. Now, why is this important? Well, of course, the old idea, my enemy's enemy, it must be my friend. The Arabs hate the Jews. The Nazis types hate the Jews. And, of course, Ellen is actually talking to Stephen Jones. He's limited in what he can say, but he can answer yes or no to her questions. And he was very gracious in giving the interview, wasn't he?
You know, that was so exciting. Yes, I mean, it really was to have 3 hours face-to-face with Timothy McVeigh's attorney at the time when he was still involved with the whole process of defending Timothy McVeigh. This was before he was taken off the case. And so lo and behold, I get the opportunity to talk to him about his defense. And of course, as you say, he could only say so much, but he did tell me, he said, "Ellen, if you think you're on to something," he said, "let's do it this way. You can ask me questions, and I will say yes or no." And he said, "beyond that, I won't say anything, but I will just tell you if I think you are right or wrong." So this three-hour interview I had with him consisted of, "well, Mr. Jones, this is what I think happened, or this is what I see in this scenario. Could this be possible?" And then he would say yes or no.
And, of course, what the average individual is never allowed to know is that Terry Nichols was over in the Philippines. Who was he meeting with? Why, Andre Ramsey Yosef. Who was Ramsey Yosef? Why, he was, of course, working with Osama bin Laden. And of course, this whole thing, in fact, Ramsey Yosef was meeting with Terry Nichols in December of 1994 and January of 1995. Ramsey Yosef was the man responsible for the first attack on the World Trade Center. He was also involved with Operation Bajinka, the plan, of course, to hijack American planes and crash them into buildings. And that was, of course, discovered in 1995. But they can't let the American people know that because, after all, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, had said, "who would ever have thought that they would hijack planes and crash them into our buildings?" They knew that in 1995 for Operation Bojanka. And here's Terry Nichols over there. Somebody's giving him a lot of money to take repeated trips over to the Philippines to meet with these Islamic terrorists who were working over there. And they were planning on hijacking our planes, 10 of them, and blowing them up at one time. They were planning on trying to kill the Pope. They had all sorts of plans. And here is Terry Nichols. But we can't let the American people know that. They'd realize Timothy McVeigh was not the loner that he was made out to be. The other thing is that if you read Stephen Jones' wonderful book, Others Unknown, and it's the second issue, the second volume, the Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy, he will tell you that, and the opening defense that he gave, why he got up and he said, well, of course, Timothy McVeigh told his sister that he was part of a special forces military unit involved in illegal activity. And, of course, the media totally blocked that out. The media, of course, never mentioned that, and neither did the prosecution. Why? Because if the American people understood that Timothy McVeigh was in special forces involved in an illegal activity, it might put an entirely different complexion on what we think happened there in Oklahoma City, and maybe even what the Muslim terrorists might think actually happened. So why don't you pick up the story from there? Because it's a fascinating, fascinating story.
Well, having spoken with Mr. Jones and having interviewed so many people in the temple movement and archaeologists and so forth, I set about to have my hero, David Rothmeyer, piece together with linguistics, studying of old documents, old manuscripts and so forth going back eons, and then also coming up into the World War II period with documents from the concentration camps, and piecing together the lineage of the hoped-for high priest going backward in time and then forward in time. And then, of course, we bring in the genetic capabilities, the testing of genetics. And ultimately, in my story, of course, the priest is found.
But, of course, in the meantime, while you have these Islamic radicals who hate the Jews, and they will do everything they can to block this effort, because, of course, the last thing they want is for the Jews to be able to one day rebuild their temple and begin their sacrifices.
Right, and I do bring out very clearly in my book, and it's one of the very major themes in the book, the international connectedness of these terrorist organizations, that the militia movement in this country with its anti-Semitism is indeed connected with other terrorist organizations around the world which do have an anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish agenda. And, you know, to this day, we're talking 5 years after the book came out, that aspect of reality has yet to be brought out in the secular media or in the common media. The fact that we have homegrown terrorists right here in this country, and we're not talking about Middle Eastern people at all. We're talking about good old homeboys right here in the United States who do have links to the Arab world and are involved in attempting to squash Israel. But that's nothing new. That's nothing new. That goes back to Hitler and even before.
And what people really don't understand is that there were, of course, many of the Arabs who were very, very supportive of what the Nazis were doing.
Uh-huh.
As far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, he was a dedicated socialist. He ran a Nazi-type nation. And, of course, people really don't understand that the Ba'ath Party was a Marxist socialist party. Exactly like, of course, the Nazi Party was the National Socialist Party in Adolf Hitler's Germany initially was. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Ellen Gundersen Traylor, and, of course, we'll invite your calls from out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course our regular listeners up in the state of Washington are going to be away from us for about 4 minutes, and so there are a couple of questions that I want to ask you when they come back, and that would be, of course, what happened to your book, because you've had some very strange circumstances surrounding this book, but there's information here that really is very provocative. It's all based upon fact, and they really are actually putting together the robes and the candelabra, and all of the things that will be necessary for the beginning of the sacrifices, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And anybody can go and see them today in Israel, right there at the Temple Institute, right across from the Wailing Wall. It overlooks the courtyard of the Wailing Wall, and you can see the trumpets and the harps and the robes and the all the implements and the plan for the temple and so forth, all in place there. It's just an amazing display. And, you know, it seems as though very few tour groups going to Israel are even aware of that little display.
I know. I've been there, I think, 5 or 6 times. And I think, as I recall, we were only there actually one time to actually see the Institute. And I'm not even sure that our tour guide took us there. Maybe he did. But, you know, at least we did have an opportunity. And these magnificent, a candelabra must be, 6 feet tall, something like that.
Oh, at least. Uh-huh.
I mean, man, I saw a lot of these things are solid gold and solid silver. And believe me, they got big bucks invested. But they are really intent upon this. Well, it was very interesting. You were mentioning that some of the people there at the Temple Institute were really very worried that you were getting too close to something. Did you have that same feeling?
Oh, absolutely. Well, they were uncomfortable discussing it, that's for sure. And actually, it was really one man, but he would have been speaking for all of them because he was the curator there and the one in charge. And yes, he was concerned. He wanted to know what I had already learned and what I had found out before he would speak to me about any of it. So he was rather leery of, and his response, really, the only answer he gave me to my question of how they would locate their high priest was that God would provide.
But
I knew that there was more to it than that.
And, of course, he didn't mention the fact that they were working on this special genetic study to determine how they would identify the lineage of Aaron. I think that's really so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot more to it, too. You know, they have special houses where they are raising young boys from childhood on. From infancy, I have heard, to be groomed for the priesthood. You know, there's the high priest, and then there are many, 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 many priests under the high priest, to run all of the affairs of the temple and so forth. And those have to be Levites or Kohanim. The high priest has to be a Kohanim. But there are many priests and Levites who would be running the all of the affairs of the temple.
All right, we're going to have to just wait for a moment because, of course, our listeners up there in the Great Northwest are joining us right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening, Ellen Gunderson Traylor. Her book that we're talking about is The Priest, and the second one is The Oracle, the second in the series, and the third one hopefully will be coming before long. But if you have never been to our website, it's radioliberty.com, and we have all of her books listed there, and the pictures of them, and a little blurb on what each one is. Fascinating, fascinating books. This is the sort of thing your children and grandchildren should be reading, the biblical stories of old that will help shape their outlook on the world. And, of course, they're great reading for anybody. In fact, my wife, very often when we take trips, would take one of Ellen's books along and read it to me. And she has every one of Ellen's books. And I've either read them or she's read them to me. And so really a wonderful, wonderful stories of adventure. But of course, they all draw us back to focusing on the Lord. So let's talk a little bit about what happened to the priest, because actually something sort of strange happened to the book, didn't it?
Oh, the book, yes. Well, you know, to this day, I really don't fully understand what went on. I did finally get my rights back to the book.
But what happened to the book? What about the distribution? Here they're so anxious. I mean, you've written, I don't know, how many books have you written?
16.
16 books. You're a well-known author across the country. You've just finished your book on Jerusalem for the publisher. And now you write this book, The Priest. Mm-hmm. And so what happens?
Well, it got out there and it sold quite well, and it was doing well. And then all of a sudden, I could not get any copies of The Priest. And obviously, if I, the author, could not get The Priest, who could get The Priest? And bookstores were calling me and asking what was going on, why they couldn't get The Priest. And so I had to begin a little investigation and discovered, and here I had an order of my own, which had been a standing order for several months, and I never got the books. Suddenly the well just dried up. I could not get any copies of The Priest. And I finally got it out of a couple of people at the company, one who looked it up on her database and said, well, it says here that there were 7,000 copies and they were destroyed.
They were destroyed just like that. Why would they destroy a book that they could sell for money? There's a demand for them. You want them. And, of course, other people want them, the bookstores. What did you touch on that was so important that just accidentally they'd destroy 7,000 books?
Well, I never did quite understand what this destruction idea was all about. And then I began to find copies of my book on the internet, brand new copies of my book out there floating around for $2 and $3, as though somehow they had, I do not fully understand, Dr. Stan, what happened here. All I know is that suddenly, out of nowhere, without even telling me about this at all, I had to learn it by investigating, that my book had been declared out of print. I don't think I ever told you that part of it.
No, you didn't.
It not only had they, quote-unquote, destroyed, whatever that means, destroyed 7,000 copies. After the book was doing well, it was out there, it was touching a nerve, people were loving that book, I'll tell you, and suddenly it was out of print.
And you couldn't get any place, and then there's other copies.
I couldn't get any. And what copies there were out there were going for peanuts.
And then they're selling them that cheaply, then you aren't going to get any sort of a royalty on them.
No, absolutely not. You bet I didn't. Not on those.
So anyway, of course, there's something a little mysterious about what happened. You're not quite sure what it was.
I don't understand what happened, but I raised a real fuss, I'll tell you that. And then the book was brought back into print all of a sudden for a while.
And then what happened?
And then the same thing happened with the Oracle.
Well, but of course, if the companies are really, printing books to make money, you would think that, of course, they would keep the books, they would put them out, they would circulate them as long as there's a demand for them. But
and they were doing well with it, Dr. Stan. You bet they were. I mean, I'm a bestseller. My books have always done well.
And, of course,
this is the first time I ever saw a book abandoned that way, all of a sudden.
It's the first time yours have. Of course, when you do the sort of work I do, you find that books that get too close to the devil's heartbeat often meet the same fate. We'll be back here in just a moment with Helen Gunderson Traylor. We'll invite your calls from out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Ellen Gunderson-Traylor. We're talking about her books, The Priest, The Oracle. So there's a little element of mystery here about, but if you want to get it now, are you publishing them yourself at the present time?
Well, what I did when I demanded my rights back was I purchased as many remaining copies as I could that were still in their warehouse. There were some, okay? And I was able to get those. And then when I run out of those copies, I will reprint them myself. So, but I do own the rights now, and they are available through me.
All right.
And you.
And we actually carry these books because we think they're important books. And we have all of Ellen's books. And you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and you can look at them. And they're just wonderful reading. They're wonderful gifts there. But they're really the sort of thing that our young people should be reading instead of the trash that they're getting in school. So wonderful stories, but they all have a truly wonderful scriptural message. But so anyway, of course, the story of the priest, we won't, of course, tell too much because we don't want to destroy the story for the people. Other than it's a fast-moving, there's adventure, there's all sorts of things in the story that make it fascinating reading. It's hard to put down. And then, of course, at the end of the book, why, of course, they actually track down the priest. But you have to understand, if you're a Christian listening to the program, that, of course, the Jews are waiting for the Messiah to come. But the Messiah that, of course, is going to, their Messiah that they think is going to be their Messiah, at least the Christian believes, is going to be the Antichrist, that the real Messiah will come at a later date, and, of course, to claim his own. But, of course, this is a very, very difficult situation because the Jew, totally dedicated to the coming of the Messiah, he's been waiting for really 4,000 years now for the Messiah to come. It's been prophesied down through the ages. But, of course, the Christian, looking at what this is going to happen, believes that, of course, the man who will come and will actually reign from the great temple will be the Antichrist. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. And so what happens now with the legitimate heir to the priesthood, there must be one out there, okay? I mean, there must be a legitimate heir to the high priesthood in existence.
All right.
What is going to happen to him?
Well, we won't tell him any more than that, because
okay.
Then we'll get the book and read it, and I don't want to spoil it for them. But then, of course, that is the priest. Then, of course, the second book is the Oracle. So after, of course, David Rothman, is it Rothman or Rothberg?
Rossmeyer.
Okay, after David Rossmeyer has actually found the priest, then he wants to go back and just have a nice, comfortable life as a university professor. Then they say, well, no, but of course, the one thing we still need is the Oracle. And of course, this is something most people have never heard of. That, and of course, the ashes of the red heifer. The red heifer is so important to the Jews, because of course they need either the red heifer or the ashes of a red heifer for their proper sacrifices. So why don't you tell, we'll introduce them to the Oracle, because after they've read the priest, then of course they're going to want to read the Oracle as well.
Okay. Well, as I said earlier, what good is a temple without a high priest? And then secondly, what good is a high priest if he doesn't have the necessary implements to perform his duties? Those are being provided by the Temple Consortium or Temple Institute now, but some of the things they don't have, which are essential to the high priestly duties, would be the Urim and the Thummim, otherwise known as the Oracle, which was kept inside the breastplate of the high priest. We don't know just exactly what those were, but it is believed by most scholars that they were some kind of little ivory or bone counters, they call them, or like die, a pair of die.
Like dice,
right. That would have been thrown, and they would have had marks on them, and they would have been tossed to determine the will of God in critical matters. Now, this was done down through Jewish and Hebrew history at points in time where a king, a Jewish or Israelite king, would need to know God's will on certain matters, such as do we go to war or don't we go to war? Who should be the legitimate king or whatever? There were things that only the oracle could determine. And this was not some fanciful thing. This was something that God actually gave to the Jewish people, to the Israelites, to help them determine his will at critical junctures. Nobody knows, I think it's safe to say that at this point in time, nobody really knows what became of the oracle of the Urim and the Thummim. Well, if we have a high priest who needs to perform these duties, according to the ancient traditions, he will need that oracle. And so David Rothmeyer is sent off on another adventure to track down these two itty-bitty pieces of ivory or bone, which would have been kept in the breastplate.
Now, did the same thing happen to your second book that happened to the first one?
You mean at the publisher?
Right.
There was a problem of about 5,000 books being mishandled.
Okay.
They didn't use the word destroy, but there were books never accounted for.
All right, fine. So anyway, of course, now you have the rights to that one back again as
well?
Yes, I do. And you have copies of that available for
yes.
us, and we've gotten them from you. I think my secretary was saying that we're getting down a little bit, and so she's going to be calling and ordering some more of them, because
okay.
they are moving people. Once they start to read Ellen Gundersen Traylor, why they get hooked, and Ellen's really just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful storyteller. And, of course, I don't know how she has time to do that because, of course, she has a full-time job. And when do you actually get a chance to write?
You know, I just have to make it. And fortunately, I have good people working for me, so I don't have to be in my shop all the time. I have a bookstore, as you know. And, in fact, I've just recently written another book, and it's in the process. I'm determining how it will be published. If it's not through one of my regular publishers, then I will be publishing it myself. It is not one of the David Rothmeyer stories. It's another book, but I'm working presently on the third in the series of the David Rothmeyer stories.
Well, after you've read the first two, you'll want to read the third one. And so I've been, every time I talk to Ellen, I said, now, when are you going to have that third one out? I'm looking forward to reading that.
Everybody does. You know, I think that I felt so thrown and almost like defeated by what happened with the priest and the oracle that it's been really hard to get my bearings and get my to get in sync again with that. But I know that the Lord has a story there for me, and I have started it. I just am having trouble, and so I would appreciate... I'm not having trouble writing it. I guess I'm having trouble with the confidence that it will go forward. You know what I mean? Because of what happened to the other two. And so if your audience wants to pray for Ellen Traylor, pray that I'll push past that barrier.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, when you get close to the devil's heartbeat, you're going to reach, you're going to meet spiritual resistance. And I think that I think there's some things in that story of the priest that there are people who would just as soon not get out, because exciting things lie ahead, and then terrifying things too for those who don't know the Lord. But I believe we're moving towards a climax in history, and you know it all centers around Jerusalem and that that prophecy that cup of trembling, which is Jerusalem, will once again very soon become the center of the world. American troops permanently stationed in the Middle East, and ladies and gentlemen, do not believe when they tell you they're going to be home by Christmas or November, or no, they're planning on keeping our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And of course, I can say that because I've read the plan. It's in the website, newamericancentury.org, the publication of the PNAC group, this small group of people who controls the government, and of course it's called Rebuilding American Defenses. Their website, www.newamericancentury.org. Go there, and of course if you get my newsletter, let's see, that would be the March newsletter. Why, of course, it tells you exactly where to look on the that report, and they will tell you the plan is to maintain our troops in the Middle East. So what does this all have to do with? Well, we can look at it from a geopolitical point of view, or we can look at it from a spiritual point of view. And when you look at it from a spiritual point of view, you get an entirely different picture than from the geopolitical, because God has his hand, I believe, in what's going on today.
Well, just to give you an example of the kind of subterfuge that goes on, really, to try to waylay the Jewish rebuilding of the temple, I touch on this in both my books, but there are schools in Israel where they are training young men, boys, for positions in the temple, and right about the time that I was writing the Oracle, just prior to when I started the Oracle, there was an assassination in the streets of Jerusalem of two young men as they were coming out from one of these schools. Now, this appeared to have been done by Arab terrorism again, but why did they target these two particular young students as they were coming out of one of these training grounds for the temple?
I give up. Why did they do that?
Well, I am sure that they were attempting to waylay the training of possible priests for that temple. And I think that that was just one very tiny little example of what they would do if they could. They would do much, much more if they could to bring about the end of all that activity. But here you had two innocent young students being trained for that kind of activity, and they were snuffed out, completely taken out, for no good reason that makes any political sense, any economic sense. I mean, they had done nothing, but they were being trained to take part in the future temple.
Well, now, do you want to discuss at all your views on how they're going to be able to build a temple there without creating a holy war? Because if they did anything at all to the Mosque of Omar, why, of course, it would bring the vengeance of Arabs from all over the world, Muslims from all over the world, down on
right.
the Israeli people.
How do I think it can come about?
Right. Do you want to touch on that, or should we hold that off for
well, no.
the book? Of course, I can't even buy the book. That's the trouble, because it's not written yet. But, of course, these are exciting things that are happening, and these are really momentous events that are taking place today. So what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, they can't really pull this whole thing off without bringing the whole world against them. And we know, according to the scriptures, according to the prophets, Zechariah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, so forth, that in those days, the whole world will come against Jerusalem. So it's a given that when they start this activity on Mount Moriah, or on Temple Mount, or at the Dome of the Rock, however you want to put it, it will not be done peacefully. It will bring about a conflict that will engage the entire world against Israel and against Jerusalem. So that being said, how then will there ever be a temple built there? How would it ever come about? You know, nobody knows for sure, and I don't think the Bible really gives us any clues specifically as to how that Dome of the Rock will be eliminated, but there are clues as to how it might happen going on right now in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, actually underneath Mount Moriah, under the Dome of the Rock. The Arabs are, even as we speak, digging out huge mountains of material from underneath the Dome of the Rock and hauling it out by the truckload and dumping it in the Kidron Valley daily. And there's been a hue and cry incredible in the Jerusalem Post and toward the Israeli government to stop this, not to allow it to happen, etc. You don't ever hear about it in the secular press. But one of the main reason that the Arabs are doing this is to destroy any evidence underneath the Dome of the Rock, within the tunnels and so forth, and underneath that big area that the Wailing Wall fronts against, eliminate any evidence of Jewish history. Because, you see, the Arabs say that the Jews have no claim to that mountain, that they actually have, there never was a temple there, that that's all a fabrication, it's all a lie. And so, in order to prevent the world from knowing the truth, they're having to eliminate the evidence, the archaeological evidence, underneath that area by the dump truck load. Well, in the process of doing this, they are actually undermining the foundations of the Dome of the Rock.
And there's another massive mosque there. It's called the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's about 1,000 years old or more anyway, too. And they're undermining that.
Yes,
and
they
as a
are.
Result, of course, the, I don't know, that's the South Wall?
The South Wall, which is where the steps led up to the temple. That would have been, you see pictures today of those steps going up there, and tourists can walk up those steps today. Those are the steps where the people of Israel used to come and go on their way to worship in the temple. And that area now, the wall there facing south, is beginning to bulge, and they're desperately trying to patch it up to keep it from just giving way and collapsing and bringing the... I'm sure that their great fear, and with good reason, is that the entire Dome of the Rock and everything surrounding it could be caving in.
God works in strange ways. He does have a sense of humor, doesn't he?
It is rather humorous.
Well, anyway, of course, somebody, a caller, just wanted to get the mailing address. You have a website. Do you want to give your mailing address or perhaps your website?
Oh, they're welcome to look at my website, and everything is on there that they would need to contact me. Just put in ellentrailer.com, ellentrailor.com, and that'll take you right to my website. Or if you just want to put Porthole Books, you can find me that way too.
All right, and of course they can't have difficulty why a caller can call me and I'll help them. So it's either www.ellentrailer.com or portholebooks.com, all one word. Or if you have difficulty, why call me off the air tomorrow and why we'll help you. But Ellen's course is a big help to me as he helps me get these books that are out there that we need to get the information to you that you're not going to get from Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. And so she's been really a wonderful, wonderful help through her bookstore in tracking down hard-to-find books, books that just are not available in the local bookstore and are not readily available even on the Internet. Oh, she finds them, but sometimes they're frighteningly expensive. But, of course, on the other hand, why a good book is like a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody's run the price up to something phenomenal, you wonder, of course, what's in that book that might very well be important to help us understand what's going on.
And why is it that I can almost get one for you, Dr. Stan, and then suddenly it's gone? Or it gets lost in the mail?
Well, the strange things happen, but of course, when you see these things happening, you almost have a feeling that there's somebody out there that might be working against us, and whether it's people or whether it's spiritual, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care, as long as we're doing what's righteous and certainly adhering to our beliefs in the Lord. Well,
right.
Of course, what's going to be the title of the last book?
The next one will be The Cornerstone.
The Cornerstone.
And I will be having David Rothmeyer set out to find the original footprint of the temple.
Oh, that should be fascinating because, of course, the history of Temple Square and where the temple will have to be put is really one of the great questions. And everybody has a different opinion. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to find out looking forward to finding out what David Rothmeier finds out about where the temple is going to be situated. And, of course, really what a wonderful experience it has been to be in Jerusalem, I guess, half a dozen or more times. And I really wouldn't want to go over today because things are really very, very uncertain. But you've been there many times as well, haven't you?
I have. And I want to go again. But now, right now, I think it's... They are going over there with less trepidation, but it changes daily or weekly. And so if you think that you might want to go, just be sure to really check out what's going on. Keep your finger to the wind so that you know if it's safe or not to go. I don't believe in being foolhardy.
No,
it's very dangerous.
Right now, of course, I will tell you, the Jewish authorities do everything they can to guard the tourists. I mean, you are probably, as safe as you can. They're probably the safest people in all of Israel because they'll have people there guarding you because they don't want anything to happen to the tourists because they need tourism to help to finance their country. And the tourist industry, one of their largest sources of income has been sorely damaged because of course, the terrorist attack.
Right.
Well, we're just about out of time. What are the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, I would really like to hear from anybody out there who has questions. I do try to answer my emails. I try to give personal answers on these issues. So if you read the books or if you just have questions about it, anything we've talked about, please feel free to contact me. And again, look at ellentraylor.com. And as always, pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Well, amen. Thank you so very much for being with us. It's been always a pleasure.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, our guest was Ellen Gundersen Traylor. Her books we're talking about, The Priest, The Oracle, but there's so many other books there. Certainly her book on John, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. And Mary Magdalene really comes to life in that book. And, of course, Jerusalem and Melchizedek and so many of the other biblical characters are described taking the sound biblical story. And then, of course, doing a tremendous amount of research for the time and the effort. There's one on Samson. And so I want to recommend them to you. And if you'd like, of course, to know more, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And they're all listed there. But, you know, this is the sort of thing, as I've said twice before, and I'm going to say it again, this is what you want your children reading. This is what you want your grandchildren reading. So many of the books that are out there today give the children the feeling of hopelessness. Do not give them the moral foundations. And, of course, the biblical stories have that moral foundation that will help them, all throughout their lives. Well, this is the time, of course, when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there across America listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We, of course, because of the turndown in the economy, there were a number of people who had supported us regularly for years, just lost their jobs and are hurting. And I'm sure a lot of people are still hurting. The economy's picked up some, but we had said that there are at least 9 million people out of work here, maybe more than that. I mean, they're not all on the unemployment rolls because a lot of them have simply run out of their benefits and some of them have almost got discouraged and just simply given up. So if you are somebody or you're in a position to help us, don't be bashful. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our June newsletter, which I personally think was a very important newsletter, it goes into the background of all the new diseases that are plaguing mankind. I mean, where do these new diseases come from? Where did Ebola come from? And why are there so many different strains of the Ebola virus? And why does this not exist in the wilds of Africa, but exists in laboratory monkeys? So why would that be? And, of course, the same thing would hold true. Why new diseases like Lassa fever and hantavirus? Although hantavirus has been around for a long time, it never was found in America. until it was found, of course, on an Indian reservation in the Southwest. And, of course, there's some people who feel that Indians are more or less dispensable people. I don't. I believe every person is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God. But we begin to see these outbreaks of new diseases, of West Nile virus. Where did West Nile virus come? The first outbreak was in 1999, found in New York. An article 3 months later in the New Yorker magazine said that the CIA, this is 1999, the CIA said that Saddam Hussein did it. And we wondered, did Saddam Hussein did it, or was this, of course, an effort to conceal the truth about the origin of the West Nile virus and so many other things? Well, anyway, it's a fascinating letter. The June newsletter, if you don't take the newsletter, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to go to our website. It's radioliberty.com, and you can pull down all of our newsletters. They're going back many years, and there's a tremendous amount of information there. And everything we do, of course, is documented. You can find out where we got the information we put there. It's not necessarily my opinion at all, but it is, of course, based upon the research that we're able to obtain from other people. And so you can check out all the facts. And if you need the documentation on anything, feel free to call us or contact us, and we'll try to get you that information. And then it's up to you to tell other people about our radio programs, to get them to begin to listen, because the greatest gift you can give to a friend is the truth and an understanding of the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're involved, because truly we're involved in the spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. People don't like to acknowledge that God does rule in the affairs of men and God is involved in what's happening, not that he's responsible for the evil, but he's allowing it to happen. But one day, I believe he is going to intervene. And it reminds me of that bumper sticker I saw saying, "The Lord is coming back soon," and boy, is he mad. And I think that, of course, although we may smile at that, why, of course, there's nothing more horrible or frightening than a conflict with the wrath of God. And this once great country that had been so richly blessed, and you see what's happening in Africa today, and Liberia, and Iraq, and other countries, and how richly blessed we have been. And, of course, how do the American people respond? How do our political and religious leaders respond, to try to preserve our nation, to try to do what's morally right in this world, to bring freedom and happiness to others? We abandon our situation. We abandon our concepts of republic, and we embrace democracy, which always leads to dictatorship. It always has down through the ages, and you can go back and read Plato's Republic. He'll tell you democracy always descends into despotism. The writings of certainly Anthony Tyler, many years before the Constitution was written, where he said, democracies are temporary forms of government. They last only until the people find they can vote themselves into the public treasury, and then, of course, they go bankrupt and become dictatorships. Is that the way we're going? Well, look and see what our deficits are, our trade deficit, our national deficit. And when they say $450 billion, they're lying, of course. They're lying to you about the $250 to $300 billion additional that they're stealing from Social Security. Well, we're in real trouble as a nation, but mainly because we've turned our back against God. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. Please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, we'll be back again once more. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Stand back to Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But of course, we ask you to hold your calls here for the time being. We're going to have with us Maurice Smith, and he's going to be talking about, well, something a little unusual. He's going to be talking about something they have in China. They call it the home church movement in China. And, we know that in China, why, of course, the people have to go to home churches because the government church is not allowed to speak on so many issues. And besides that, when you go to the government church, why your name is known, you are part of the membership there. And then, of course, they can discriminate against you because you are a Christian. Well, here in the United States, there is also a growing home church movement, really, I think, motivated because many people cannot find a church they feel really preaches the gospel. And, of course, the Catholics, brothers and sisters, they're having a terrible time. They've pretty well destroyed the Catholic Church. They infiltrated the seminaries 50 or more years ago, encouraged homosexuality, got their people promoted into the highest levels, into the positions of bishops and cardinals, and yes, and they even got their Satanists in there. And there are, if you don't believe, there's Satanism, and certainly within the Catholic Church. Why, you need to read the book, of course, the Windswept House by Malachi Martin, or get our 4-tape set on Malachi Martin, called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, a Jesuit priest who tried to point out what's really happening. I have a very good friend who's a traditional Catholic, and he says, you know, the Jesuits who still believe in the traditions of the Catholic Church are few and far between. They figured they'd lost every school that they had. Every school that they had has been taken over by the dark forces. They've preserved one, and it happens to be up in the state of Washington, very interestingly enough, and we've actually interviewed people from that one school. And there are not even very many Jesuits on there, but of course there's one school that at least holds the traditional Catholic beliefs. But we shouldn't, of course, sit around and gloat, you know, what's happening to the Catholics, because the same thing is happening to the Protestant church. I mean, the church no longer talks about sin and no longer talks about hell or eternal punishment or God's wrath being brought on people or nations. We simply remove that, although it was taught, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, but they very subtly, very cleverly infiltrated our seminaries and changed the music and the message of the Protestant church. And we get calls all the time from people across America saying, I live in Loboga, Ohio. Do you know of a good church around here? And we have to say, well, we really don't. But, I mean, of course, sometimes we'll put them in touch with our special guest tonight, Maurice Smith. Maurice, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Stan, for having me on tonight.
Why don't you tell us what motivated you to get involved with the home church movement here in the United States?
Oh, mercy, that's a long story. I'll try to make it a short one. I wrote a book back in 1995 entitled Preparing to Survive the New Age, New World Order. And it's out of print now. Chuck Missler and the Koinonia House folks were wonderful about selling every single copy I had, and they got the word out. And when I was researching that book, I began thinking about what is going to happen to the church if all of the things that we talk about happening in the world today, if those things do indeed come about, you're not going to be able to go down to your local neighborhood institutional church and worship the way you have in the past. It simply isn't going to happen. Now, I don't know if it's not going to happen this year or 10 years from now, but the trend is there that the institutional churches as we know them are targeted because they are the last bastion against the rising tide of New Age paganism that is sweeping not only across America, but across the world.
But of course, isn't even many of the mainstream churches, haven't they altered their the service? Haven't they altered their teaching? And increasingly, even many of our mainstream evangelical churches are embracing some of the New Age beliefs and some of the New Age teaching.
You know, it's across the board. It's almost like politics. You know, I say the only difference between a Republican and a Democrat is they're both going in the same direction. One just gets there ahead of the other. And the same can be said, unfortunately, I believe, in the area of most, I won't say just denominational churches, but it's most evident there. My wife and I spent 7 years in the Presbyterian Church USA, and I love that church. Unfortunately, they are on a slippery, greased slope, and they're sliding fast. They've fallen from 4 million members down to under 3 million members, and they're losing people at the rate of 40,000 people a year. But that's just one example. The result is, across the board, that the institutional church, whether they are independent and evangelical, or whether they're traditional mainline denominations, they are now, and they're going to be, under ferocious attack because, again, they are the thumb in the dike, and the dike is giving way. But people know that in order to accomplish the New Age, New World agenda, they're going to have to eliminate the voice of the church. And I've got an article currently on my website, which is perusianetwork.com. I'll spell that a little later. But I talk about the most recent Supreme Court decision regarding homosexuality and what that's going to mean for the ministry of the church. It's going to become like a 10-pound sledgehammer that is going to be used to absolutely beat the senses out of the churches to get radical homosexual agenda adopted in every single church in America, because the churches are the last bulwark, the last bastion of biblical, I won't say traditional morality, I will say biblical morality, left in America today. And once the church is compromised, then the agenda can proceed. So what's happening is an awful lot of people, it's estimated 10 million born-again believers in America alone, have bailed out of traditional institutional-type churches, and they're going into alternative forms of church, and particularly the house church movement, which is where I'm at. And that's what started my journey back in 1995, 1996, and I now have a chapter that I've written in a book that I prepared called The Perusia Strategy, which is my complete rewrite of my earlier book, Preparing to Survive the New Age, New World Order. And I've got a complete chapter in there about preparing to become an underground church. And I believe that day is coming. I don't talk a whole lot about it in our local ministry here. We try to keep Jesus the main thing of everything we do. But philosophically, I believe that we are headed where China is today. And I believe that the rise of the underground church is going to be a product of the fact that we are a post-Christian, post-modern, you might as well just call it a pagan culture. And it's forcing us to the fringe, and every place where that has happened, such as in Russia, or in the former Soviet Union, in Nazi Germany, in China, the believing church gets forced underground. And I believe that day is coming very quickly in America.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with you at all, and the fact that there has not been an outcry from the churches across America demanding the impeachment of the Supreme Court justices, who, of course, have abandoned their responsibility to uphold the Constitution that they swore to uphold. The fact that the church teaches, oh, God put them there, so you are to obey them, and to object to what the Supreme Court justices are doing and legalizing homosexuality, or legalizing partial birth abortion, or the killing of the unborn. Why, if you object to that, you're in revolt against God. And nobody, of course, the average parishioner simply accepts what his minister says without ever stopping to think, you know, of the implications of what he's doing, and the realization that had our founding fathers, of course, believed the message that's being taught in the apostate church of today, Why, of course, we'd still be British subjects. It wouldn't have been an American Revolution.
That's very true.
And, of course, this is what the tragedy is. And, of course, we could spend a whole hour talking about Romans 13 and how this has been twisted by those people who destroyed it. But I will simply point out that they used the same thing in Hitler's Germany, and those of you who haven't read Erwin Lutzer's wonderful book entitled Hitler's Cross, need to get it, and realize, of course, the same message was preached from the pulpits in Hitler's Germany that is being preached in America today. And why? Because the same spirits of forces that energized the Nazi Party and the Nazi movement are alive and well in America today.
You're absolutely right. I talk about that, in fact, I believe in Chapter 3 of my my book, The Parousia Strategy, The Occult Roots of New Age, of the New Age thinking and the New Age New World Order today. It's the same stuff that gave rise to Hitler's Germany. It's the same nonsense that gave rise to Lenin and Stalin in Russia. It's that same occult spirit is at work. And if we don't crush it spiritually, it's already sweeping across this country in just pell-mell fashion, and it's showing up in churches as well. And that's why the other side of our ministry, in addition to promoting house churches, we are trying to call Christians in, we're starting right here in Spokane, where we are in Spokane, Washington, trying to call Christians together to pray for genuine revival and outpouring of the Spirit of God, because I am convinced, personally, after I wrote a book on the Welsh Revival of 1904 entitled When the Fire Fell, it's out of print now, but it's posted on our website, I'm convinced unless we have revival of historic proportions, then we are probably doomed as a nation. And I don't want to be doom and gloom, but I think we are a culture, a civilization, and a nation that is living somewhere between the book of Jeremiah, which talks about God's judgment upon religious rebellion, somewhere between the book of Jeremiah and the book of Acts, which is a book about revival and renewal. And I don't know which way it's going to go, but I'm deeply, deeply concerned that we may see the unfolding of the book of Jeremiah in our own day. And so we're trying to call Christians to begin praying in their marketplace and taking a stand for righteousness and for prayer where they work. We call it the Spokane Marketplace Prayer Initiative, and we're combining that with our house church outreach to get Christians out of this passive attitude that has been ingrained. Most Christians believe the church is something that happens between 9 o'clock and noon on Sunday morning, and they don't take their faith with them out into the marketplace on Monday through Friday, and it's absolutely destroying us as a nation.
And of course, you know, you're fortunate up there in the Spokane area to have the American Christian Network, and at least a Christian voice that you can reach people with. And, you know, this is just so important. In fact, we are so fortunate in America to have the Christian radio that you just don't find any other place in the world. The tragedy is, of course, that so much that we hear on Christian radio is totally counterproductive. And, of course, I'm sure many of the people are very well-meaning, but, of course, I think that they're part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Now, we have some wonderful, wonderful programs on Christian radio that I certainly support and applaud, but we have an awful lot on Christian radio that, and especially on Christian television, but more so on Christian television. It really it's just so unbelievable. You know, I'm sure that God must probably turn off the television set when those things come on. Well, anyway, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there across America, you agree, you disagree. Maybe you think this is not a problem, but I get this so frequently from our listeners and our supporters across America who call and they say, we can't find a good church. Well, you know, there's no perfect church out there. And with that old line of Groucho Marx, you know, it's like a club. You know, if I found a perfect club and I joined it, it wouldn't be perfect anymore. And the same thing with the church. But, you know, if you find one that preaches the gospel, that's the important thing. And there will be doctrinal differences. But the important thing, are they true to the word? And do they preach, of course, that we are all sinners saved by the grace of God? And, of course, they preach about the wrath of God people don't like to talk about the wrath of God, but of course that is a very important part of the biblical teaching. At least it was until recent years, when we transformed God from a God of justice and righteousness and love, mm-hmm. certainly, but also a God of judgment, into sort of a big fat Santa Claus with a red suit who just passes out love offerings to everybody because he loves everybody. And as someone once said, if God is only love, then it would be the ultimate triumph of evil, because of course there would be no judgment for and no punishment for sin.
Yeah, if folks listening want to go to our website, which is Parousia Network, that's P as in Peter, P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A, ParousiaNetwork.com, we have a study on the book of Jeremiah that we're doing. When you talk about God's wrath and God's judgment, to study the book of Jeremiah is very, very sobering, because the book of Jeremiah was written to a people who are known for being God's people. And it's a book about how displeased God is over the way his people are behaving in the culture of which they are a part. And I think it has tremendous parallels today, because I think God is speaking to the church today to get its act together and to realize there are many things within the church as well as within the culture of which we're a part that God is very displeased with. And a good, healthy study of the book of Jeremiah is a wake-up call to how seriously God takes these things. And for that reason, we've been going through a study on the book of Jeremiah. We're only up through about chapter 6 right now. We've been at it a while, but it's such powerful material. I went back and found an old book entitled Death in the City by my old mentor, Dr. Francis Schaeffer, which talked about what it means to be a post-Christian culture. And he was going through the book of Jeremiah and talking about, you know, God is not pleased with the things that are going on in our culture. And that was 25 years ago, you know, before the Supreme Court decision regarding homosexuality and many of the things that have unfolded today, Dr. Schaeffer predicted 25 years ago. And the wrath of God and the message concerning the wrath of God keeps us healthy in our understanding that there is a price to be paid for disobedience. And our culture, my fear is that we are on the verge of paying that price in spades in the very near future. And that as a church, you know, we need to issue a call to come together in prayer and repentance, asking God to have mercy and to send revival instead of judgment. And God offers out the opportunity that if we will respond, if we will respond in faith and in repentance, that God does offer mercy to us. Whether or not we'll see widespread revival, I don't know. I am praying for it earnestly, because it's either that or judgment, and the church has a great deal to lose.
Amen to that. But of course, Jeremiah was the weeping prophet, because of course he saw that the people of Israel were not going to repent. And you know, I'm criticized for saying these things on the air. If I was just of course talking about, you know, why we want to elect a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian, why I'd probably be a lot more popular. But I believe that of course we have to tell people about the spiritual component of this battle. Mm-hmm. Because that's, of course, where the rubber meets the road. Not whether we have a Republican in the White House who is going to betray us, or a Democrat in the White House who's going to betray us. But, of course, the thing is, of course, what is God's plan? What are the people, how are they responding? And what, of course, is God going to do? Because eventually he is going to intervene one way or the other. And, of course, I pray for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. So said Thomas Jefferson, but I think those are such beautiful words. Let's go to Mike, who's calling with a question and a comment. Well, let's get the comment first and then the question.
Well, my comment has to do with the use of labyrinths here in, at least in Santa Cruz area.
You're talking about one of our churches has the labyrinth, so you could draw closer to God.
Yeah, one of our two largest churches here in Santa Cruz area. I think all parents with kids in the youth programs should consider their children spiritually endangered if they're involved.
Well, now, what's wrong with a little labyrinth? Isn't that what, of course, that the rats run through?
Well, labyrinths can take many forms, but it's a completely pagan Wiccan practice that will eventuate in the demonization of anybody who walks it. And I just wondered if your guest knows anything about how widespread this might be, or if he's heard of it.
You know, I really have not. What I look at when I look at churches today, I see a desperate desire on their part to attract and to entertain people with novelties. That is, we've got something new to offer, whether it's a labyrinth. I have no idea what they do, whether they're running kids through a maze or whatever. My concern, without knowing the details of this in particular, is that much of the activity of the church today boils down to little more than entertainment, because we've got X number of hours to fill. We've got people who come, they want programs, and they want to be entertained, and so we come up with new programs like this or like others to keep people entertained. I don't know what the spiritual dimensions are of this particular program that they're running, but I do know that the entertainment problem is endemic throughout churches today, and that concerns me. The purpose of church is not to entertain. It's to challenge, it's to equip, it's to build the saints up, get them out of the pews and back out into the world during the work week, where we share the gospel and begin taking territory for Christ. And we need to get people out of the entertainment mode and into the training and equipping mode, to where they are well-grounded in the Word, well-grounded in their faith, with a passion to go out and share the gospel outside the four walls of the church, and, like I said, to begin taking territory for Christ.
Well, Mike, tell us about the labyrinth. Have you seen it at all? Do you know what it involves?
No, but there was an email that was circulated that came from the youth leader of the unmentioned church, describing the process he went through in acquiring it from Saddleback Church, and that's where it seems to be emanating from across the nation. It can take all different forms. It can be a pathway marked off on the floor, or it can be more like a maze where you can't see.
But wasn't it sort of to get you into meditation?
Yeah, there are points you stop off along the way, and you progress through different levels of meditation. And this is much worse than simply a boiled-down, entertaining version of Christianity. This is a purely occult practice. And there is demonic activity associated with this, and it's unavoidable for anybody who immerses themselves in this. And I'm glad I'm not one of those youth leaders who's going to have to stand before God someday with this.
Well, you know, of course, I've heard some people who've been involved with Satanism commenting that they're very concerned about this because they really understand the implications of the meditation as you open your mind. It's sort of like playing a Ouija board. There's not, you know, it's just simply a board there, and you put your hands on it, and you just sort of open your mind to these forces. The trouble is that when you open your mind to the forces, sometimes they come in.
Almost all the time they'll come in.
And, of course, for those who don't know Mike, he was with us for how many years?
18 years. I spent 18 years in all sorts of paganisms before I became a Christian at age 36.
Right. Anything, pardon me, Maurice, did you have something to say?
No. Mike's perspective, if what he is saying is true in terms of what this labyrinth is being used for, and what it would be nice if we had a call from someone who has actually been through this or has some first-hand experience on it, but if what he is sharing is true, that it involves spiritual activity, meditation, I'd be much more concerned. All of a sudden, my red flags start going off when those kinds of things start.
It absolutely is a spiritual activity. They're using it as a spiritual activity to heighten themselves in a spiritual experience. But it's occultic, it's demonic, and these kids are in treacherous waters.
And, Chris, what you're really talking about is experiential Christianity. In other words, you want to experience Christianity.
No, this is experiential occultism.
Oh, well, I know it is, but, I mean, they don't tell anybody that.
Well, they're turning,
tell them this is how you're going to experience Jesus.
Yeah, they're turning Christianity into a so-called experience.
Okay.
Which is not where it's a relationship. It's not an experience.
All right. I'm certainly not going to disagree with you at all. If you're out there in the listening audience, you know anything about this or in any other community, give us a call. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. I know maybe you disagree with Mike, but we'd like to hear what you have to say if you're listening out there. Anything else, Mike?
That's all. Thanks.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much. And But I really believe the church is under attack. I believe that, after all, if I was the devil, I would, of course, not try to attack Christianity from without. I'd attack it from within. And I think that that, of course, is exactly what's happening today. As you change the message and the approach and the music of the church, and music is such a powerful, powerful force, and the average individual has no idea how effective music is in controlling our attitude and our outlook. But I think it was Aristotle or Plato who said, if I could control the music, I could control the nation. And they understand that. It's just the average American doesn't understand it. And he doesn't know what happened to the old hymns. He just knows that something is different, the beat is different, the music is different, and it's not like it used to be about that old-time religion. Well, Maurice, is the home church movement in America growing rapidly?
It is. I get emails on a regular basis of people who are contacting me looking for house churches. I'm in touch with other networks. There are increasing numbers of conferences taking place. The Southern Baptists have begun moving into house churches. I know the official Southern Baptist house church planner for the Dallas Baptist Association, wonderful young fellow who graduated from Southwestern Seminary. And in the country of Ecuador, the missions planting team in Guayaquil, Ecuador, Guy and Linda Muse and their team, and they are only planting house churches. The Southern Baptists discovered in Ecuador that in a 40-year period of time, they had planted 40 traditional churches, about one church a year, and it didn't take them long to figure out. They literally sat down and looked at this and said, you know, if this is all we do, we will never see the nation of Ecuador reached for Christ by planting one church a year. And so as a result, the International Missions Board of the Southern Baptists in Ecuador is no longer planting traditional churches. They are only planting house churches because they can plant them quickly. They spread quickly. It's catching on like wildfire in other parts of the world. America is slower because we are very institutional and entertainment-oriented. Church is something that happens in a building on the corner of 1st and Main on a Sunday between 9 a.m. and noon every Sunday. And that is very much a part of our culture today. But it is a part of our culture that is actually killing us because our witness is being stymied. People are being taught to be passive in the pew, come for 3 hours, listen to somebody else preach, and then go home. You've done your Christian thing. In fact, I have a friend, or he's a leader in our house church network here in Spokane, and we're developing marketplace prayer, and in his business where he works, there are several Christians in the business. He went to one of them and said, would you like to come pray with me on Tuesdays and Thursdays during the noon lunch hour? We're gonna pray for the office, for the people around here and so forth. And this Christian fellow looked at my friend and said, well, why would I want to do that? I pray in church on Sunday.
Well, now, of course, I want to know what really happens in the home churches, how they work. Mm-hmm. What about a leader? Is there a leader there? Is they having, how can this function without some sort of a titular leader? So let's just start. We've got about a minute before we've got to go to the break. How does a house church work?
House churches work almost like a family works, and that is there is leadership there. That leadership simply needs to be assumed, and it needs to be exercised. We encourage the raising up of elders within a house church. And a house church may consist of 3, 4, 5 families meeting together. And after a period of meeting together, leadership begins to come to the surface. That is, God raises people up, and it becomes clear that God is anointing a certain person to lead this group. And so you go with God's anointed leader as opposed to an institutionally appointed leader.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a few minutes with Maurice Smith and talking about the home church movement. We'd welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Marie Smith of the Home Church Movement, and of course he's coordinating the movement up there in Spokane. And is the Spokane area growing fairly rapidly in the Home Church Movement?
It's starting to catch on. There are a good number of house churches or home churches that are meeting. The problem is they're not networked with anybody, so nobody knows they're there. And so I discover on a regular basis, somebody says, oh yeah, we've been doing house church for 5-6 years. And
right, now, are they bringing in a video from perhaps some responsible minister? Are they playing tapes? Are they somebody in the group giving the sermon? Are they having songs? How does it really work?
Well, everything you just mentioned takes place in one form or another. That is, in our house church, I lead a house church every Sunday evening here in my home, and we have about 5 families that are involved, and we have listened to tapes. I'm teaching through the book of Jeremiah. Somebody leads worship, songs. We have times of open prayer. We share needs. We lay hands on one another and pray for healings and pray for you know, whatever's going on in people's lives. Once a month, we have a potluck meal together, so that we'll get together about 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening. Everybody brings something, and we'll sit and eat and talk about what God's doing in our lives, and we'll share the Lord's Supper, literally over the dinner table, just like Jesus and the disciples did. And so, all of the things you've described, watching a videotape, or listening to a cassette tape or something by some other pastor or speaker, all of those things take place. We are in the process, I believe, of changing the cultural definition of church. Church is not an organization that meets in a building on the corner of First and Main on Sunday morning between 9 and noon. Church is believers coming together to share the Word of God, to worship together, to meet one another's needs, and to equip one another to go out and share the gospel in their neighborhoods. We're having a, 2 weeks from now, we're having a neighborhood block party in a neighborhood park, and we're going out and putting handbills on 150 doors of houses around that park, inviting people to come and have a hot dog and potato chips, and there's face painting for the kids and so forth. And we're basically introducing ourselves to the neighbors and passing out a little tract entitled, Can We Pray For You? I'm asking people what their needs are, that we're Christians and we'd like to get to know them. And it's a preliminary step in sharing the gospel with them and inviting them into our homes. Come and experience house church with us. And come and hear more about what Christianity is all about. And you may be hearing the gospel over a hot dog as opposed to hearing it out of a pulpit. But that's where people are today. Here in Spokane, Washington, only 18 out of 100 adults attend any form of church. So if you want to present the gospel to them, it's not going to be on Sunday morning, because they're not there. And so the church has got to find a way to reach out into their neighborhoods. We have got to begin redeeming our neighborhoods as the first step to redeeming our communities, which is a step towards, by God's grace, redeeming our culture and bringing it back to the gospel. It's only going to happen as Christians get outside the four walls of the traditional church and begin sharing the gospel. We can't be running scared of the New Age, New World Order and what's happening there on that level. We need to be bold as lions to take the gospel into our homes and into our neighborhoods, begin sharing the gospel and saying, hey, okay, if you don't want to come to church building down here on the corner of First and Main, would you mind coming over to the house Sunday night? We have a group. We get together for prayer, for Bible study. We worship together. We listen to tapes, and we'd like for you to come and just be and just see what Christianity is all about on a one-to-one personal level. And that's basically what house church is.
Well, that's a fascinating approach. A lot of the families getting their children out of the government schools and trying to homeschool. Is this something that many of the people in the home church movement are doing, do you know?
We have a lot of homeschoolers. In our network here locally, we have a high number of homeschoolers. My wife and I homeschooled for a number of years. Our children are out of the house now. They're in college and beginning to step out in, on their own, and we're just proud and tickled because God has blessed over the years through homeschooling and the things that we've been involved in. Our children are doing well. So we understand the homeschool movement. We have many families that, in addition to homeschooling, are beginning to do house church. It's not always homeschoolers, but we do have a fairly good number.
Okay, so the sort of people who are interested in home churches often would be the same ones would be aware of the fact of what they're doing to our children in the public schools. And so these are people who are willing to be sort of nonconformists and saying we're going to do it differently because we feel that this is what God is moving us to do. Would that be a fair statement?
I think it would be a partial but fair statement. I think what is happening, Stan, is all across America, Christian institutions of every form are being shaken by our culture. We're losing the culture war on just about every front.
We sure are.
And that is having an effect of shaking the church and shaking Christian institutions and shaking Christian families and forcing us to ask the question of what are we doing wrong? You know, on my website, I have on one particular page in a series of articles, I have reproduced Pliny's letter to Trajan back during about 113 A.D. when Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, which is Turkey or Asia Minor, was writing to the Emperor Trajan about the problem he was having putting Christians on trial. And you go back and you read that letter. I've got it posted, again, on my website at parousianetwork.com. And it's on the House Church Resource page that we have posted there. And Pliny describes the church as, he called it a contagious superstition that was spreading everywhere through every social class. And, you know, when Rome finally... Well, when Christianity conquered Rome, or however you look at it, when Constantine finally converted to Christianity, historians estimate that the Christian population was somewhere between 5% on the low side and about 20% on the high side. Well, our Christian population in America today, supposedly, is above at least 20%, and yet with roughly the same percentage, let's say, of born-again believers as the Roman Empire had in the early 300s, we are losing our culture, and yet the Christians were slowly conquering the Roman culture. And my question is, what are we doing wrong?
All right, I'll ask the question, what are we doing wrong?
Well, I think one of the many things that we're doing wrong is that we have bottled our Christianity up into institutions with four walls and a building and an organization where we teach passivity in the pew, we teach people to sit and listen and behave themselves. We don't teach them, hey, the only reason you're here on Sunday morning is to pick up some more ammunition and some equipping and to get prayer. You need to get back out into the world, and you need to begin taking territory for Christ. You need to be sharing the gospel in your neighborhood with your neighbors. Wolfgang Simpson, who's written one of the most influential books on the house church movement, it would be wonderful if you could get Wolfgang on your program sometime, but he's hard to get hold of, lives in Germany. Wolfgang says, we don't go to church, we are the church. And we need to start developing that mentality among Christians all across America. We need to, and people are going to get upset by hearing me say this, we need to stop going to church, and we need to start being the church. And that means you need to start being the church in your neighborhood. You need to start being the church at your office, at your work, at your employment. We need to quit going to church on Sunday, and we need to start being the church on Monday through Saturday. And that's the goal of the house church movement, is to start being the church in our homes, in our neighborhoods, and in our workplaces, because that, by the grace of God, is going to be the only way that we are going to have a significant impact on our culture and begin taking it back for Christ.
Well, of course, a lot of people will say, but, you know, if you're going to be controversial if you talk about Christianity. You'll be a lot more popular if you just don't bring out, you know, your religious values. And after all, there's some people who don't want to hear it. So how would you answer that?
That's the price of being a Christian. The early Christians, the first 300 years of the church, if you mentioned the name of Jesus and you claimed to be a Christian, you were arrested and thrown to the lions. And yet, the early Christians conquered Rome. Rome didn't conquer the Christians. I know there's a lot of debate about Constantine and so forth, but my point is, they were willing to pay a high price to see Jesus exalted and to see the gospel go forth. And I would encourage folks, go to my website at parousianetwork.com. That's P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A, parousianetwork.com. And go to, let's see here. I'm looking at the website right now. In the site menu, down about midway, says more house church resources, articles, links, etc. Go to the house church resources there. If you click on that, it'll take you to our house church resources page, and down towards the bottom of the left-hand column, you will see Pliny's letter to Trajan. Read that letter. I want your listeners need to read that letter and see what the early church under persecution, this was the church within 20 years of the death of the Apostle John, what the church was like, and they were being persecuted, and yet Pliny says, man, this contagion, this superstition is what he calls it, is spreading through all the provinces, through the cities and the villages and every social class. Pliny was concerned that this thing called Christianity was spreading like a wildfire. And, of course, he was absolutely right. And the result was that the Romans lost and the church won. We need that same kind of virility, that same kind of contagion in Christianity today, but it's not going to come. It's not going to take place if we're afraid to be the church out where it counts. And that's why they also need to read my letter on homosexuality that's on the homepage there at parousianetwork.com, because this is a huge challenge. Every evangelical church in America, every institutional church, is going to get hammered on now over the issue of homosexuality, and you're going to have to take a stand for moral purity. You won't have any choice. They're going to be very in-your-face about it. I've had some experience with this in the Presbyterian Church, and I would encourage folks to read the article there on our website.
Well, of course, the difficulty is that the church doesn't want to be confrontational. We want people to like us, and of course, we're told that you should always turn the other cheek, and that you should never you never oppose anything that's being done by government, because God is behind everything that's going on today, and I've heard the minister get up and say, if you object to what the government is doing, then you are in revolt against God, because God put those people in power over you, and of course, you are to be obedient. And that is the message of the modern-day church.
Well, it is, and it's unfortunate. I've said many times in public that I don't know many Christians today that I would want to go through World War II with, because these people would get me killed. They don't know how to respond in the face of evil.
And, of course, that's really what it's all about. We are involved in a spiritual battle of good against evil, or the people of God against the people of the dark side. And the dark side is winning because most Americans don't even believe the dark side exists.
No, they don't. They're happily blind and naive. They don't want to know, because if they know, then of course it makes them accountable, and that opens up a whole can of worms. You know, it's like the old story that Erwin Lutzer tells in that wonderful book that you mentioned.
Hitler's Cross. Right.
That's a good book. People really should get that and read it, and then they should read a biography of Pastor Niemöller during that period of time. And he tells the story about the church that was next to the train tracks, and the train to Auschwitz would pass by, and the people knew what was going on. They knew what was on the train, so what they would do is they would play the organ louder and sing the hymns louder so they wouldn't have to listen to the passing train, because everybody knew where that train was going and what was on it. And unfortunately, that's much like the church today, that's much like our world today. whether the issue of homosexuality or the issue of abortion or any of the great moral issues of our day, just sing the hymns louder so we don't have to listen to the prick of our conscience. We know what's going on, but we would prefer to ignore it and hope that it'll just go away. And unfortunately, it will not go away in our day any more than it did in World War II.
Well, of course, you know, they will be. If you are talk about abortion, why? Of course, people are going to be offended. Maybe the man who encouraged his girlfriend to have an abortion, or the woman who's had an abortion, they don't want to hear about this because it makes them feel bad.
I understand completely, because I helped to found and run a Christian pro-life organization when I was in seminary in Denver from 1978 to 1982, and we were just seminary students, but we founded a ministry of Christian apologetics and wound up spending most of our time on the pro-life issue, and you have no idea the heat that we took from churches and from pastors and from, I had women come running up to me, dragging their teenage daughter behind them and sticking their finger in their face after I spoke on pro-life issues, saying, you know, if my daughter gets pregnant, we're going to go out and get an abortion, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that was in a major evangelical church in Denver. So I know exactly what you're talking about, Dr. Stan. But we have to take a stand on the great moral issues of our day. We have no choice.
No question at all, and we've got to do what's right. And whether, of course, somebody once said, you know, praise or blame that follows that counts just the same. And our job is to do what's right and not do what's popular. Well, of course, you know, I think it's exciting to know that there is the movements going on, that it's a very quiet movement, but it is growing, and of course, there are more and more people who realize, of course, that they're going to take a stand, and they're going to have the courage to pull away from what we've always done before. Now, if you have a good church where, of course, they're preaching the gospel, then I certainly encourage you to support it and to support the minister. But if you don't have a good church, and that is the problem that we have in so many places across America today, and I get calls, and I'm sure you do as well, Maurice, from people and saying, you know, where is a church in my community here in southern Arkansas or wherever it may be? And people, I know some people tell me they'll drive 50 or 75 miles on Sunday because that's the only place they can find a church. Oh, there are all sorts of other churches, but I mean, they're compromising. They're changing their whole outlook because they want to be popular. And of course, the church growth movement is one of the greatest dangers today, because of course it compromises principle for political advantage and for profit. And of course the church growth movement really, of course, works. All you do is change the message, you bring in the people, and you entertain them, and you make them feel warm and fuzzy, and you make them believe that they have nothing to worry about because God loves them, and an awful lot of those people are going to spend eternity in hell because they got a false message.
You're absolutely right. I want to encourage your listeners, and we have some wonderful listeners there in the Santa Cruz and Monterey Bay area. The last time I was on, I got several emails and letters from folks in your area. But I would like to encourage folks to visit. We have two websites. I've mentioned the Parousia Network. That's P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A. That's a New Testament word for the Lord's return, Parousia. ParousiaNetwork.com. And we have a second website called MarketplacePrayer.org, MarketplacePrayer.org, and those two sites will cross-link to each other. You'll see a link in the Marketplace Prayer website on the upper left-hand corner that'll take you to the Parousia Network website. And I want to make sure that your listeners get a positive word here. We can spend an awful lot of time talking about what's wrong, and we've barely pricked the surface of some of the things that are plaguing the church today. But I want to encourage your listeners to pray for revival. That really is the hope of our nation. It's not getting more conservative talk radio. It's not getting more Republicans elected. It's none of those things. The hope of America, if there is hope, is that we pray and ask God to send genuine culture-transforming revival and renewal, just as he did to England under Wesley in the 1740s, 50s, and 60s. We need that kind of revival today. It can happen. It could happen. God can send it. But there really is a call for the people of God to pray earnestly and to repent, to pray in an attitude of repentance for God to send revival into your community, right where you live. That's what we're doing here in Spokane. And that's why I would encourage listeners to take a look at our marketplaceprayer.org website, because, yeah, there's an awful lot of things wrong, and house church is one of the solutions to many of the problems of the institutional church. But if we don't have revival, if we don't have Christians praying in the marketplace, praying for God to come and give us a fresh culture-transforming touch of his presence, then we really are going to be in serious trouble. And so the church needs to pray. So I want to encourage all of your listeners to do that.
And, of course, you know, if you look at that period, 1740, 1750, there was Wesley, there was Jonathan Edwards, and, of course, Wesley was over here for a time and doing
part of that.
And, of course, that was the first great awakening. Here in the United States, America had turned away from God. America was on the way to destruction. We were a very young nation. We're, what, at that time, 130 years old from the time of the Jamestown colonies. And, of course, America was on the ropes. And revival did come. And, of course, they didn't have radio. They didn't have television. They just had a few ministers that went around, among them Jonathan Edwards and Wesley and, of course, one or two others. And they transformed society. People don't understand that. It was out of that first great awakening that came the seeds of the American Revolution and
That's
the Declaration
right.
of Independence and our Constitution. And this nation then had such a profound impact on the rest of the world as far as, of course, promoting Christianity was concerned. And then, of course, a few generations later, why, of course, you had falling away again. You had the second great awakening.
That's right.
But people have forgotten the story of America's Christian heritage and the influence, of course, that revival had upon the founding of this country. Let's go to Joan here. We're getting a little short on time. Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stant. Real quickly, I was driving and I heard the question about the labyrinth.
Right.
And when I go to the Gorbachev State of the World Forum, they normally have a venue at the Grace Cathedral, for example, with Jane Goodall, and they make it a point of incorporating the labyrinth. They have an extensive labyrinth there.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I don't really know a lot about labyrinths, except that when I go to the Gorbachev conferences, a main component of that, of course, is the occult. And so this is one of the things that they incorporate into their activities. And then the best resource for understanding what the labyrinth entails is Dr. Kathy Burns' book, Masonic and Occult Symbols, which you probably still carry.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we do.
And there are many, many references in here to the labyrinth, and it just has a lot of ancient symbolism. Albert Pike said that it represented the sun, and it's a symbol of the eastern star, and it's a symbol of the goddesses, and so these ancient kind of religions, and it also was used in the Tibetan mandalas and the Hopi Indian medicine wheels, so it's connected to a lot of ancient things, and of course it's a big thing in San Francisco, where Gene Houston introduced the labyrinth to the Episcopal priests.
And of course, when we begin to see them coming into our own communities, and what you're really doing is meditating, and I understand there's a little pond or a little pool of water or something, and you drop in a pebble and you see the other ripples go out. I haven't been to it at all. All I know is what I've been told. But all we're doing is simply opening up our mind. Exactly as you do with the Ouija board or any of these other occult things. And people said, no, this is a Christian labyrinth.
No.
And they really don't understand.
No.
And I'm sure many of the people who actually develop these, they're just looking for a novelty. We want to bring the people in. We want the people to be happy. We want them to come back again. We want them to experience Jesus Christ. Well, as Mike said earlier so well, Christianity is not an experience. It's a relationship.
Exactly. Our Christian brethren really need to become a little more familiar with the occult to understand what they're dabbling with. Thank you.
Okay. God bless you. Thanks for calling, Joan.
Okay.
We'll see you later this week.
Right.
We got
Bye.
A two-hour program. I think it's Thursday evening.
Yes.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. Fine. That's Joan, who of course has been to the Gorbachev State of the World Forum and of course all of these international meetings so she can bring us back an understanding of what's going on. And we are so blessed and fortunate in this area, and of course the other areas where we reach out Joan will be talking on Thursday evening on the USA Patriot Act. At least the first hour will be heard up there in Spokane. And Maurice, I hope you'll get any of the people up there who are interested, who enjoy talk radio or this sort of programming to tune in so that they can help us to spread the message. And the more people we can reach in Spokane, the more people we can hope to bring into the movement which you're leading.
Well, Stan, I appreciate your having me on tonight to talk about what God is doing in the house church movement. And I do want to just encourage your folks, all who are listening, to this wonderful programming that you put out, to pray earnestly for revival and spiritual renewal here in America, because it is our only long-term hope. You know, when you look at how the European Union has very intentionally turned its back on God and this new European constitution, Christian roots are being abandoned at a breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking pace historically. When you consider how long it took to build those roots, to see how quickly we are abandoning them now is absolutely stunning. And the church is the only thing that stands in the way. It's not conservative politics, it's not Republican politics, it's not John Birch politics. It's only the church, it's only Christianity that stands in the way of the flood tide of New Age paganism that is flooding over the Western world, which is our cultural atmosphere, but it's sweeping the entire world as well. And that's why the church is coming under increasing attack, and that's why I believe eventually, if we don't have revival, we are going to see the church becoming an underground church, and your listeners are going to be in house churches whether they want to or not. So I encourage them to check the website.
All right, fine. Let's. What about your email? Do you want to put that out in case anybody
wants certainly. We're always open. You can send anything at all to administrator@parousianetwork.com, P-A-R-O-U-S-I-A, parousianetwork.com. Just put it administrator, or you can put Maurice at parousianetwork.com, and please feel free to send me an email. I'd love to correspond with your listeners, and you have a wonderful audience there in the greater Santa Cruz area. And I hope that we can be of service to them in the house church movement.
Well, I hope you can, too, and I hope that this movement will take off. I think that this certainly is the way we're probably going to have to go in the not-too-distant future. God bless you, Maurice. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, and I hope we can get you on again on some of our other programs.
Thanks, Dan. Good night now.
Good night. God bless you. Okay, fine. Well, that was Maurice Smith, and I hope you enjoyed our program this evening. And, of course, I think that this is a movement that will be growing increasingly in the months and years that lie ahead. As America moves increasingly from a post-Christian nation to a pagan nation, and of course this is the way that it always is, whenever a Christian nation turns its back on God, God eventually, of course, turns its back on that nation, except for that small remnant who are loyal to Him. And of course, we may have to, of course, go to the home church movement to express that loyalty, because our regular churches may very, very well soon become like the three self churches of communist China. Oh, that could never happen. Well, why not? Couldn't it happen? I mean, after all, of course, we already are finding tremendous pressure on the church to change its teaching on homosexuality and other things. And, well, we don't even have to have government pressure. We have the pressure from the people. We don't want to be controversial. Don't talk about abortion. Don't talk about homosexuality. Don't talk about politics. Just tell us that God loves us and everything's going to be fine. Well, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and our protection, we hope many of you will join the Radio Liberty family and join us in this epic struggle to determine that this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. So until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye. May the Lord be with you.